Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on Amazon, the National Labor Relations Board, and captive audience meetings featuring William Messenger and Roger King. Bill Messenger is Foundation Vice President and Legal Director at National Right to Work Legal Defense and Education Foundation. He was a staff attorney for over 20 years and during that time represented individuals in numerous cases that sought to expand worker freedom of choice. This includes acting as lead counsel in three cases before the United States Supreme Court, including successfully arguing Janus v. AFS-CME Council 31. Our moderator today is Roger King. Roger is Senior Labor and Employment Counsel for the HR Policy Association. He's also served as a partner at Jones Day, a captain and legal services officer in the United States Air Force, and a professional staff counsel for the U.S. Senate Labor Committee. He has testified before Congress and represented employers in many high-profile labor and employment law cases, including co-counseling the winning side of the landmark Supreme Court case, Noel Canning. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco, and good morning to everyone that's been able to join us this morning, or good afternoon, depending on your time zone. Bill, it's great to be with you again.
Great to see you.
Let's just go on with it. This is one of the most important decisions in decades from the National Labor Relations Board, certainly one of the most controversial. So let's start, though, with a little history about Section 8C and free speech rights for all stakeholders under the NLRA. What's your take in this area?
Sure. So just sort of, it's interesting to know the history of it because, you know, the captive audience meeting case that we're talking about here, the Amazon decision, is really part of a larger sort of NLRB sort of censorship, you know, type regime of what employer speech is permissible under the National Labor Relations Act, and the mandatory meeting case, sort of small part of it. So to sort of get the bigger picture, it's good to know about, you know, Section 8C and how free speech is sort of developed under the Act. And the Act, as originally written, only actually gave a right to unionize. And the original board back in the 1930s, 40s, took the position that employer speech against unionization was illegal. Just sort of they required so-called employer neutrality. However, the Supreme Court said that violated the First Amendment in a case called Virginia Electric and Power, which sort of said, no, First Amendment principles apply. You can't basically censor all employer speech about unions and unionization. Eventually, after that, as part of the Taft-Hartley amendments in 1947, Congress actually added something to effectuate the First Amendment within the National Labor Relations Act. And that's known as Section 8C, which is 29 U.S.C. 158-8C. And what it basically provides is the expression of views or the disseminations thereof shall not constitute an unfair labor practice absent a threat or promise of benefit. And so 8C was the idea that that's the statutory sort of restriction on the board's authority, which was supposed to protect, you know, the ability of free speech both for and against a union. As a result of Section 8C, the court has sort of said, Supreme Court, that this sort of shows congressional intent to have robust and uninhibited speech about unions and unionization. However, notwithstanding that, the NLRB for the last, you know, 70 some years has taken a very restrictive view of 8C and has often found a lot of ways to try to restrict employers' ability, usually employers, sometimes unions, ability to take refuge under that statute. And so what the board has generally done is, again, Section 8C basically says speech is permissible unless it carries a threat or a promise of benefit. Well, what the NLRB has often done is basically said that just about anything carries with it an implied threat or an unstated and implied promise of benefit, and therefore the NLRB has the ability, you know, to censor it. So before we talk about the mandatory meetings, an example comes out of the Amazon case that we'll discuss in a minute. Amazon had an open door policy, and it basically told employees, we have an open door policy. If you have any concerns about unionization or about wages in terms of conditions of employment, you have an open door, you can speak to us. The board said that any solicitation of grievances, something like that, an open door policy, carries with it a legal presumption that it carries with it a promise of benefits, and therefore is something that can be considered illegal under 8C, based on that idea that it carries an implied promise. So 8C, again, is supposed to effectuate the First Amendment, supposed to protect and free speech under the Act, but as a practical matter, the board has largely gutted it over the last, you know, since it's been enacted in 1947. One question we can talk about later in the future is whether or not it'd be possible to breathe more life into 8C, be sort of moving forward, but that's sort of where we stand now with respect to speech under the Act.
Well, that's a great analysis, Bill. Let's stay with 8C just for a minute. So 1947, Taft-Hartley Amendments, Congress amends the statute, is reacting to case law, reacting to a previous prohibition on employer speech regarding unionization. So the legislative history, as I recall, doesn't have a great discussion, any depth, in-depth discussion regarding 8C and previous court holdings. But what's your take? Did Congress clearly recognized an issue and a problem in this area? Could one conclude that as a result of 8C then being included in the Act?
Oh, yes, that's the way the Supreme Court's interpreted. You know, Chamber of Commerce versus Brown, the most recent decision, said, you know, viewed one way, Section 8C implements the First Amendment under the National Labor Relations Act. And that, you know, makes sense. I mean, obviously, the NLRB can't restrict speech to the extent it violates the First Amendment. So for 8C right. to really have meaning, it basically effectuates the First Amendment as a statutory matter. You know, the NLRB can't violate, you know, censor speech in a way that would violate the First Amendment. They just did that under 8C, which if anything is, you know, can't be narrower than the First Amendment. If anything is broader, it's like a prophylactic, you know, sort of prohibition on, you know, NLRB censorship that absent a threat or a promise of benefit, you know, that's not speech that the National Labor Relations Board has authority to suppress, you know, as a statutory matter.
Yeah, and I would personally and professionally agree with you. 8C is a very interesting development. And for those of you that have joined us today that don't regularly practice under the National Labor Relations Act, do take a look at 8C. It's a very important provision. And as Bill just mentioned, it certainly codifies and even, I think, expands, frankly, free speech rights in the workplace. And this is free speech not just for employers. We need to make that clear. It's free speech for employees. It's free speech for unions. It's free speech rights for all stakeholders under the Act. And I think, Bill, as you bent, the court's been quite clear that a robust discussion regarding workplace issues and issues surrounding unionization, pro or con, are encouraged and supported by the courts. Is that a fair conclusion?
At least in terms of their general statements, the Supreme Court has made very clear, you know, that an uninhibited, robust debate, you know, is encouraged in the Act. There's supposed to be free speech. But unfortunately, as anyone here is a labor practitioner knows, you know, as a practical matter, that's not the way the board has enforced it for quite a long time. I mean, the NLRA, you go through labor law, it's a minefield of any little thing, usually an employer can say, can be deemed illegal under the Act, depending on how it's phrased, how it's taken. The board itself has said it has broad discretion to determine what speech is unlawful. Is it, in the totality of the circumstances, have a reasonable tendency to coerce employees, is sort of the standard the board has declared for itself. And the idea being that also, the actual effect it has on employees doesn't matter. The employer's motive doesn't matter. It's, does the NLRB declare as a matter of legal fiction that speech could have a reasonable tendency to coerce in the totality of circumstances is how the board believes it has authority to control speech under the Act and present. And again, as mentioned earlier with 8C, the way the board's gotten around it is just said, all kinds of different types of speech carry with it unstated and implied promises of benefit or threats, even if that's not actually there. So I think the promise of 8C really hasn't been realized, you know, by the board for quite a long time. And I think to breathe new life into it, eventually 8C is going to need to be interpreted consistent with the First Amendment and the Constitution.
Totally agree. I mean, the Constitution is going to override any board decision, one would certainly hope. Well, let's go to the case before us today, Amazon. Very important case, probably one of the most important cases in decades coming from the National Labor Relations Board and its ramifications. Bill, set the stage for us, then I'm going to intervene and ask a few questions.
Sure. So the bottom line holding of Amazon is that it's illegal under the National Labor Relations Act for an employer to have a mandatory meeting to discuss unionization, whether for or against unionization. So the idea being that if an employer requires its employees on paid work time to attend a meeting where unionization is discussed, that's illegal to require the employees actually to attend that meeting. So that's the bottom line holding, but there's a long history here of what sort of happened. Just sort of go back. This is going back into the 40s again, in a case called Clark Brothers, and this is before Section 8C was enacted in 1947. The board said these mandatory meetings are illegal under the Act. Congress responded in 1947 with 8C, and among other things, in one of the legislative history reports, said that Congress expressed displeasure with Clark. So after that, in 1948, came a case called Babcock. And in Babcock, the board said mandatory meetings are not illegal under the National Labor Relations Act based upon 8C. So this is right after 8C was enacted. And then for the last 76 years, mandatory meetings have been considered lawful under the Act. So it's been sort of nothing's changed. There's one little blip in the 50s where the board said you had to give a union equal time if an employer had a mandatory meeting, but the courts reversed that rather quickly. And that would never survive constitutional scrutiny today. But other than that, since Babcock in 1948, employers have been allowed to hold mandatory meetings to inform employees of their views about the union. Until 2024, all of a sudden, the Biden board majority declared, you know, we've been wrong for 76 years. Mandatory meetings are actually illegal under the Act for a variety of reasons, you know, we can discuss. I don't know if you want me to start diving into them yet.
So, Bill, we've had 76 years of precedent overturned by this decision. Is that a fair conclusion?
Yes.
Yeah. And Babcock and Wilcox had been the law both under Democrat and Republican NLRBs for decades.
Yes.
Fair conclusion?
Yeah. Just all of a sudden until 2024, the board says, you know what, we've been wrong all this time and changed position.
Well, and I think it's important. Under both Republican and Democrat boards, this hasn't been just a Republican board position. This has been a position of the National Labor Relations Board under various administrations for, as noted, 76 years approximately. So a very significant departure from established board jurisprudence. Well, let's dive into the reasoning of the majority for a moment. And then I want to go from there to what we expect maybe in the circuit courts as this case is challenged. And by the way, for those of you who have joined us today, Bill, this case is on appeal, correct? It's in the 11th Circuit?
Yes.
And we'll get back to the significance of that in just a moment. But Bill, I'm looking at page 13 of the majority decision. And it's interesting. I'm going to quote for a moment. I normally don't like to read from decisions and sessions such as this, but I think this is important. This is the majority. Quote, captive audience meetings intrude on this protected sphere of employee privacy and autonomy and reasonably tend to interfere with employees' Section 7 rights in at least three distinct ways. And we'll dissect each one of these, continuing to quote, first, captive audience meetings impinge upon an employee's Section 7 right to choose, free from any employer coercion, the degree to which they will participate in the debate concerning representation. So that's the first rationale for the majority. I mean, how do you react to that? I have some thoughts also, but I'm curious as to your reaction to that argument.
Sure. I think it's rather weak because it's Member Kaplan. So just there is a dissent in this case by Member Kaplan. And so like a lot of this, you know, we can talk about what the majority held and what Member Kaplan said in dissent. And so this, you know, is one of the, you know, grounds on which, as you mentioned, the board said this interfered with employee Section 7 rights, namely requiring them to attend a mandatory meeting about unionization. And the first is that it requires them to participate, you know, in a debate, is what the majority said, as you just read. And as Member Kaplan said, employees aren't required to do anything. You know, they're not required to participate in a debate. They're required to attend the meeting. They're actually, you know, they're on work time. You know, they're being paid to be there. So, you know, this right. is something the employer could control. It's not like they're off the clock. And so the employees aren't being required to do anything. You know, they don't have, in fact, it would be unlawful under the act if the employer actually made the employees, you know, say something or do something, you know, during these meetings. All the employees are doing is just listening to the employer's views on unionization, perhaps learning more about it, and that's not interference with Section 7 rights under the act.
No, and I agree. Trying to restrict participation, or at least listening to and understanding the issues associated with unionization and the free and robust exchange of ideas, is what I think AC is all about. At least one can make that argument. Certainly that's what the First Amendment is about. And I know the employer community has felt over the last 4 years, particularly, that the board has seemingly stretched as far as possible to cut off debate, cut off discussion, restrict the rights and opportunities for employees to hear all sides of the issue. And to me, that's concerning. Put aside whether you represent unions, employers, employees, debate and free speech is something we hold sacred in this country. And we ought to be encouraging the exchange of ideas, not discouraging. Well, let's go to the second rationale. Again, I'm reading from the majority opinion. I'm now at page 14. Second, captive audience meetings can readily serve as a mechanism for employers to observe and surveil employees as they address the exercise of employees' Section 7 rights. So the so-called surveillance discussion issue and argument. How do you respond to that, Bill?
With what Member Kaplan said, that, you know, in any kind of in-person communication, by definition, almost, you're going to have the opportunity to see how someone responds to, you know, the position, the speech. So almost any time an employer engages any kind of in-person communication with employees, by definition, almost, the employer is going to be able to see how people react to it to the extent they do at all. And that's not interference under the act. It would make any kind of in-person communication illegal. And then also that falls far short of what the board considers real surveillance, you know, in violation of the act, which would be like videotaping people, something like that, that might chill their exercise or Section 7 rights because they think they're being watched. But merely to say we're going to put on a presentation that's, you know, expresses the employer's views about unions doesn't constitute surveillance, because maybe potentially, you know, the employer might get some idea of how people think about the union based on their reaction. And then, of course, if the employer actually did engage in surveillance during one of these meetings, you know, by saying we want everyone to say, what do you think? That would be an unfair labor practice charge. Right. So, you know, to say that every captive audience meeting constitutes surveillance is incredibly overbroad.
No, I think that's a very sound response. And let's just explore that for a moment. The board also talks about, and I've heard this from reports of board members' presentations, if a meeting that an employer is called, mandatory meeting, let's say, starts out just to talk about scheduling issues, talk about quality performance issues, and then starts to go in the direction of or include a discussion regarding unionization, employees have the right to excuse themselves. It seems to me at that point, then the employer would have some ability to see who may be opposed to the employer's position. There you might have surveillance, but that to me makes no sense whatsoever in this whole surveillance discussion. Just a simple presence at a mandatory meeting by an employee, I don't see how one can get into surveillance from that type of situation. Any reaction to this morphing into a union discussion?
No, I think that makes complete sense. If anything, giving employees the ability to leave would make it easier for an employer to surveil what do employees actually think if someone goes barging out of the room, you know, because they don't like what the employer is saying about unionization. And then your point actually also brings up something else that Member Kaplan, you know, brought up in his dissent, is that the board's interference decision is too narrow, in that it only applies to mandatory meetings about unionization, but not about terms and conditions of employment. Because, of course, Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act doesn't just give employees the right to engage in activities for or against a union, but more broadly gives them the right to engage in concerted activities regarding terms and conditions of employment, even if there's no union in the picture. So if the board's decision was actually true, that mandatory meetings, you know, are illegal, they do interfere with Section 7 rights, that would be equally true with a meeting about wages or about pension benefits or about how, you know, the safety committees run. Basically, anything dealing with terms and conditions of employment as a mandatory meeting, you know, should be illegal under the board majority's opinion. Which is one reason why Member Kaplan pointed out the majority opinion doesn't make sense. The majority's rebuttal to that's relatively weak. They just said, well, this is where we're drawing the line on unionization, but not on terms and conditions of employment, if the meeting regards that. But really, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If a mandatory meeting for about unionization interferes with employees' rights, so does a mandatory meeting about any term and condition of employment.
Yeah, well said. Let's go to the final prong of the majority's rationale. Quote, finally, because the employer has compelled employees to attend captive audience meetings on pain of discipline or discharge, the employer's message in the meeting urging rejection or support for the union is reasonably likely to take on a similarly coercive character, period. Just as employees may reasonably conclude they have no real choice but to attend the meeting, so may employees reasonably conclude that, in fact, they do not have free choice concerning union representation, close quote. How do you respond to that?
I say that inference is completely unreasonable. The notion of, you know, having a mandatory meeting about unionization implies to employees that they would actually believe that means we have no choice on whether to oppose the union or go for the union is just, you know, speculative and baseless. It's sort of an example of how the NLRB just sort of makes things up, you know, as a matter of legal fiction of what an employee might believe, treating them almost like the old eggshell skull victim we all remember from tort law. Each of these employees would jump to that conclusion. And then, of course, if an employer in a mandatory meeting actually did create the impression that employees had no choice on unionization, that would be illegal in that particular circumstance. So, for example, if the meeting, the employer says, you have no choice, you cannot unionize, that would obviously be an unfair labor practice charge. But the notion that every mandatory meeting, you know, is illegal under the act because supposedly that inference can be drawn, I think, is a real stretch.
It would appear to me to be considerable conjecture. Their last argument for the majority supporting its position here seems to be particularly vulnerable for any kind of in-depth analysis. But let's go back to the heart of this. This entire decision is based on the content that the employer is delivering to the audience, correct? I mean, this decision, as I understand it, Bill, would not be applicable if a mandatory meeting simply discussed terms and conditions of employment regarding scheduling or vacation pay or something such as that. Would you agree with that conclusion?
Yes. By the board's own majority's decision, it only applies to mandatory meetings about unionization, you know, or against. And that, of course, brings up the whole content-based, you know, restriction on speech, which is, you know, the big First Amendment flaw, you know, with this decision.
Well, let's morph into that. And that's really where I wanted to go. The minute we get into a speech discussion and the discussion then centers around, well, what is the content of the speech? And can a governmental entity like the National Labor Relations Board regulate content? How do you respond to that? And then I want to go further into First Amendment analysis on content.
So content-based restrictions on speech, you know, violate the First Amendment. They're subject to strict scrutiny and are almost always unconstitutional. And the idea of a content-based restriction is if some restriction applies based upon the content of the speech. And remember, Kaplan made the point, hey, this restriction on mandatory meetings applies based on the content of speech. Is it about unionization? If it is, no mandatory meeting is permissible under the National Labor Relations Act. But if it's about any other subject, you know, terms and conditions of employment or DEI or anything else, it's not prohibited. So that's a content-based restriction on speech. The board majority sort of rebuttal to that is no, because it's not viewpoint-based discrimination, because it applies whether or not the employer is for or against unionization, and therefore it's not content-based. And then they even go further than that and say, oh yeah, under the National Labor Relations Act, we only have authority to regulate speech, you know, with respect to unions. And therefore, the fact we're not making other kinds of speech illegal is sort of a function of our jurisdiction as opposed to anything else.
So, Bill, why isn't this just conduct? Isn't the board here just relating the conduct of the employer? That is the fact that the employer is engaging in a content approach. Its conduct, if you will, to be more precise, is simply having a meeting that is not permissible. It's the meeting itself, not what's covered in the meeting. How do you respond to that?
Sure. And that was a major point made by the board majorities, as you said. They're regulating conduct, whether or not attendance at this meeting can be mandatory, not what the employer says. There's sort of two flaws in it. One, let's go to 8C. You know, 8C, among other things, says the expression of views or dissemination thereof can't be an unfair labor practice. So member Kaplan took the position in his dissent, correctly, I think, that a meeting to express a view is the dissemination of a message. The meetings are often held, you know, by political parties and everyone else, you know, to convey a message. And so that is something under 8C. And then turning to the First Amendment, you know, conduct, you know, usually restrictions on speech are sort of done under the smokescreen, as the 11th Circuit said, of regulating conduct. You know, these are not, but the way you can tell the difference is the regulation of conduct based upon the content of the speech. And if it is, then it is a restriction on content of speech if that prohibition is only triggered based upon the content. And that would seem to be the case here. If an employer says something about unionization, suddenly the mandatory nature of the meeting is illegal. But if the employer doesn't say anything about unionization, all of a sudden the mandatory meeting is completely lawful. So it's not a regulation of conduct because the regulation of conduct turns upon the content of the speech or the subject matter.
So the minute the employer crosses the line into unionization issues and talks about that, we're into content and we're into First Amendment strict scrutiny. Would that be a fair conclusion?
Yes. That's Member Kaplan's position, I think the correct one. This is a content-based restriction of speech, which we'll probably talk about the 11th Circuit decision, Honey Fund, and that's something that case supports.
Well, let's go to Honey Fund and the 11th Circuit. We've alluded to the 11th Circuit here a number of times already. Take us to the Honey Fund decision, explain what that is, and then we'll dissect it further and come back to Amazon.
The Honey Fund decision dealt with Florida's Stop Woke Act, a bill passed by Governor DeSantis. And what the Florida law made it unlawful for an employer to require as a condition of employment that an employee attend a training or meetings that concerned certain religious or political matters, and then defined what they were. And basically, it was meant to stop DEI indoctrination meetings. That was very much the intent, you know, of that law. It went up to the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit said this is unconstitutional, this law, under the First Amendment, because it's a content-based restriction on speech, because whether or not the meeting was unlawful depended upon its subject matter. Did it involve certain religious and other matters? And if it doesn't, the law didn't apply. And importantly, the court addressed the idea of, is this regulation of conduct versus regulation of speech? Because that was state of Florida's primary defense. So this is just about, you know, conduct, whether employees can be required to attend, not about the content of speech. And the 11th Circuit said what I said earlier, that if a regulation of conduct is triggered based upon the content of speech, that is a regulation of speech that triggers First Amendment scrutiny. And the court, the 11th Circuit, said that was the case of the Stop Woke Act, because it was based on the content. And the Honey Fund decision was discussed in the Amazon decision, both by Member Kaplan's dissent and the majority, going back and forth on it. But now that case is before the 11th Circuit, the Amazon case. And I think they're going to find it very difficult to get out from under the Honey Fund decision on that matter, given the parallels of a restriction on a mandatory meeting is triggered based upon the subject matter of that meeting. That's exactly what the board did in Amazon, and that's what happened in the Honey Fund case. And we'll see how it turns out, Honey Fund seems to be pretty on point.
Well, let's stay with Honey Fund. So if I understand the Florida statute correctly, and then the court's analysis of the statute, the minute an employer started to deliver a message that supported a DE&I initiative or something like that, the statute was applicable and there were fines that could be imposed upon the employer. But if the employer's speech, if you will, at a mandatory meeting did not get into that type of content at all, or even may have opposed DE&I, the speech and the meeting was okay. But the content trigger, again, was if any type of speech was favorable toward a so-called DE&I initiative, at that point, the employer violated the statute. Is that a fair reading of the statute?
Yeah.
And the court said that is not conduct. Yes, you were conducting a meeting, but the minute that meeting and that conduct crossed into a censorship, if you will, of what was being said and the content of same, that's when strict scrutiny and the First Amendment principles were applicable. Fair conclusion?
Yes.
All right. So that's the 11th Circuit, and that was a decision supporting a preliminary injunction. So you had a rather high standard because we had the district court issuing the injunction. So all four traditional prongs of injunctive relief also had to be met, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think the Honey Fund decision also, just following that, sort of shows how the First Amendment's a bit of a double-edged sword, when it comes to this kind of issue. I imagine whether you're conservative or on the left, you might favor certain mandatory meetings about some subjects and not about others. But under the Honey Fund decision, this First Amendment analysis, really any prohibition on mandatory meetings based upon the subject, is going to be found unconstitutional, at least under the 11th Circuit opinion, regardless of the message, of whether it's something you may support, or oppose the individual. So that's sort of interesting. I imagine many of us listening here, don't like the idea of people being, forced to, attend like DEI struggle sessions. But, the constitutional principle is the same. If, a restriction based upon the content of speech is unconstitutional, that cuts, regardless of what that speech is.
Well, this is not a DEI webinar, but clearly Honey Fund gets us right into that discussion. And I think, Bill, your thoughts are really spot on. I mean, we generally, as members of the public and as employees in the Amazon case, and employees also in the Honey Fund case, do come to work, and certainly we carry with us our personal viewpoints, et cetera. So the question then becomes, when we have a mandatory meeting, can the employer deliver a specific message? And if the regulatory body in question, in this case, the state of Florida, says no, if you cross a line at a certain content, that is a problem. So that's where I see this bigger picture, the governmental intrusion into delivery of speech as it relates to content. Is that where we are here, you think?
I believe so. And I think, the analysis in Honey Fund was pretty solid. But yes, is that, it's sort of either the state can restrict mandatory meetings based on the content of speech, which I don't think they can under Honeyfunder, they can't. But if that's true, it doesn't matter necessarily what the content is. I mean, arguably, some could say, well, certain restrictions on content might satisfy strict scrutiny and others don't. So I guess that's a way someone could try to have their cake and eat it too. But I think that's really difficult to do. Strict scrutiny usually isn't survived.
So to me, this as a practitioner and someone that regularly practices under the National Labor Relations Act, but is becoming increasingly involved in DE&I discussions for our members at HR Policy Association, this intersection of free speech, conduct, and content, I think is going to take on even more significance in the years to come, certainly in the immediate future. Well, let's stay with Amazon for a moment. We'll go back to Amazon. So Amazon has taken appeal. Case is pending, Bill, in the 11th Circuit?
Yes.
And your prediction is?
Well, I think they'll strike it down. If under Honeyfund, if not one of the other grounds, especially Honeyfund, I don't see how they get around that. And that's assuming it survives. You know, the board composition will change, you know, exactly how, you know, remains to be determined. But I'd be very surprised, you know, if the board, even if somehow this survived appeal in 11th Circuit, that the whole idea of the mandatory meeting precedent survived, you know, the board to come. So this is probably something that, you know, won't last, at least in the short term. The question is, can another board in the future come back to it one day? Probably depends upon, you know, is it struck down under, you know, constitutional grounds or not? Because otherwise, even if the current board changes position, not current, but soon to be future board changes position,
right,
what stops one from 6 years from now from doing the same? So hopefully there'll be a constitutional decision on this, which sort of puts a lid on, you know, this ever, you know, sort of coming back.
And Bill mentioned the board at present, as many of you joining us today know, the National Labor Relations Board as of today does not have a quorum. There are only two sitting members. Now, there may be a legal challenge to the president's removal of member Wilcox, albeit as of this morning, no legal challenge has been filed. And that gets us into Humphrey's executor, unitary executive theory, et cetera, which is not part of our planned discussion with you today. But the NLRB, as of the moment, does not have the ability to hear a challenge to the captive audience Amazon decision and overturn it or clarify it. So I believe then short term, Bill, we will see a decision out of the 11th Circuit probably before the board composition issues get resolved with any degree of finality. Would that analysis line up with your analysis?
Yes. Yeah. It just sort of depends on, you know, who the nominees to the board are going to be. You know, and then when are they confirmed to get the board back up? Member Wilcox, you know, we'll see, or not member, not a member now. We'll see what she does, you know, with respect to, you know, her removal from the board. But as of now, you know, the board lacks a quorum. So I anticipate, hopefully, you know, sometime in the next year or so, there will be a quorum there, but, you know, it all remains to be seen.
Right. And of course, we also have a vacancy at the general counsel level. And that the president terminated pursuant to the Peter Robb precedent, former LRB General Counsel Jennifer Abruzzo, and then her immediate successor was Jessica Reuter, who was removed Saturday. So we have a acting general counsel, Bill Cowan, and that acting general counsel has all the authority of a general counsel. So Bill, we might see some pullback on captive audience type of complaints pending before administrative law judges in the National Labor Relations Board jurisprudence system. That's certainly possible. Would you agree?
Absolutely. For better or for worse, though, because if there's nothing in the pipeline, that means that the board wouldn't have an opportunity to reverse, you know, this decision. My guess is there are priority cases that have gone past an ALJ, you know, with the same allegations, because General Counsel Abruzzo seemed to very much like this theory. So my guess is there's probably going to be opportunities for a future board to reverse the Amazon decision. But over time, assuming that General Counsel Cowan, you know, isn't willing to issue complaints on this theory, the pipeline dries up. So hopefully, you know, the board has an opportunity to voice its displeasure and return to what was the law for 75 some years, you know, in Babcock.
Well, I want to go to some Q&As that we have here. One from an attendee, quote, the board majority's position seems hypocritical. Don't union mass meetings near the workplace or unions unannounced visits to workers' houses also have the potential for surveillance and coercion? Bill, your response?
Absolutely. I mean, any in-person communication carries with it at least some potential for surveillance. You know, when you talk to somebody, hopefully, you know, you're gauging how they react, you know, to what you're saying. So any kind of in-person communication almost inherently has, you know, at least some tangential, you know, ability for surveillance. But I think that's really stretching the meaning of surveillance. You know, surveillance under the act is, you know, following someone around to make them paranoid, you know, that they're being watched, you know, so they don't engage in protected activity. Just gauging how someone reacts to speech, you know, isn't surveillance in my view.
Yeah, very interesting. We have a couple of comments and updates. And thank you, Aaron Sullivan, and also another attendee. Gwen Wilcox filed suit this morning, I'm informed, in D.C. District Court, District of Columbia, challenging her discharge. Apparently the case caption is Wilcox v. Trump and Kaplan. So, Bill, we're going to get a test, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which is
interesting because the test is the right word. You know, right. This is very much a test case for Humphrey's executor. So it's interesting. You know, she's pursuing this. This may very well become a vehicle, you know, for a large scale decision on that, you know, very large, you know, constitutional matter of the president's removal authority.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting Humphrey's executor decision, perhaps a Supreme Court ultimate decision. So, Bill, let's shift gears here a little minute. We've been talking about the National Relations Board, but states have gotten into this area. And as one of our attendees points out, California, Minnesota, Connecticut, other states have passed statutes in the so-called captive audience area. Give us a little preview of where we are there.
Sure. So a dozen states have passed these laws, which are almost all written almost identically because they're coming from the same source. And basically, the laws say that an employer cannot require that an employee attend any meeting dealing with political or religious matters. And then the definition section defines political or religious matters to include, among other things, you know, support for political party candidates, et cetera, support for a labor union, you know, which I think is interesting that they define political to include whether or not you're part of a labor union. But in any case, that's how the dozen state laws are sort of written. And their main purpose actually is to suppress employer meetings about, you know, unions, not really about political matters. It's just the way they're written. So you have 12 of these laws as we're sitting here right now, and there's four lawsuits challenging them. The Chamber of Commerce has a lawsuit in Connecticut and more recently in California. There's a case by the Illinois Policy Institute in Illinois and a case by Minnesota ABC in Minnesota challenging these laws. And there's really two counts in all these cases. The first of which is the First Amendment issue, which is the one we discussed, the Honey Fund, but also NLRA preemption, that the NLRA preempts this. And sort of the funny thing is that the board's decision in the Amazon case probably helps the preemption arguments in those cases. Because under an NLRA preemption analysis, Garmin preemption, the big question is the conduct at issue arguably protected or prohibited by the act? You know, by throwing the Babcock decision into question, you know, with its Amazon decision, all of a sudden the board has made very clear, you know, that it is exercising jurisdiction over whether or not these kind of mandatory meetings are, you know, protected or prohibited by the act. So in sort of an odd way, this Amazon decision helps the preemption analysis or arguments being made in those cases, all of which are district courts at various stages, as far as I know, those four cases.
So, Bill, my familiarity with each of those state statutes, they all get to content in one form or another, and they involve various other content regulations or approaches, but they get to content on unionization issues. Is that a fair conclusion?
Yes. Almost all of which use the phrase political or religious to define the subject matter, and then have a definition section say political and religious includes a list of things, you know, for or against a candidate, legislation, things like that, or, you know, about a union, which is interesting that they're including, you know, unionization under the, you know, rubric of political in the definitions of these statutes. But it's still content based in that if the content of the speech is political or religious, all of a sudden it's illegal for an employer to hold a mandatory meeting, you know, under these state statutes. But if it's about something else that doesn't fall under that, the meeting's perfectly okay. So, you know, the, again, whether or not the meeting can be mandatory or not hinges on the content of the speech, which at least under the Honey Fund decision, you know, should be unconstitutional.
And you used the word bill preemption. Let's just talk about that for a moment. The former general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, Jennifer Bruzzo, to my knowledge, did not intervene in any of these cases arguing that the state statutes were preempted. Is that your understanding?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe they haven't. I think so. I'm not sure. The Connecticut case has been around for a while. I don't know if the NLRB ever weighed in with that one or not.
Off top, I think the NLRB may have filed a pleading in the case, but the question I have is whether the general counsel of the board or the Biden board in any way, shape, or form intervene arguing that the statutes were preempted. And I think I'm reasonably on safe ground saying there was no preemption argument ever advanced.
Yes, which
is concerning. Again, whether you represent unions, employees, or employers, we've had a federal approach to labor relations in this country that has, for the most part, worked quite well, where we have uniformity and stability in our labor relations area. But the state's intrusion into this area as a matter of broader public policy, I think, certainly raises questions. So these state lawsuits that you just mentioned, Bill, they're in various procedural stages. We don't yet have, to my knowledge, a final decision. Is that your understanding?
Yes. The Connecticut case has been around for a while. It got sort of hung up in discovery. So I think it's getting closer to the merits now. The other three suits are relatively recent, especially the California Chamber of Commerce suit. Because it started like a lot of things. One state passes it, and then the other blue states all pile on and pass the same law. So it's sort of snowballed these kind of laws.
Well, and that would appear to be the case. Of course, the Florida case that we've been talking about, a Honey Fund, that is a so-called red state, I suppose, it went the other direction, but yet the content, speech, free First Amendment issues still surface. So again, I think we'll see some very interesting First Amendment and related decisions. So we've been talking about transition at the National Labor Relations Board. We have an acting general counsel, and we have a question from one of our attendees. Let me read it. Could the new board simply concede it was wrong in the 11th Circuit and agree to have the Amazon decision set aside? Or do we have to wait for another case to overrule Amazon? Bill, your reaction?
You know, that's a good question. Would the board have to issue another decision? Because right now, you know, going through the board's, you know, adjudicative process, they've issued, you know, that decision. Could a new board effectively reverse its own decision without issuing another one? That's answering a question with a question. But I'm not sure in terms of board procedures, if they can effectively overrule a case just by telling the general counsel, hey, don't defend it, say we were wrong, as opposed to, do they have to issue a new decision? You know, could they, for example, say, hey, send the case back, we're going to reconsider it? Maybe. But I don't know, just as a matter of internal workings at the NLRB, if they could effectively overrule one of their own decisions without actually issuing, you know, another decision.
Well, I think at least hypothetically, the acting general counsel of the board or a new general counsel at the direction of the board could decide not to file an opposing brief, i.e. just stay silent on the matter. I don't think the general counsel or the board, without issuing a new decision, could take a contrary position to a issued board decision. I think that might be challenging and probably impermissible. Go ahead, Bill.
A similar issue just recently came up in the SpaceX case at the Fifth Circuit. That's one of the removal cases. The NLRB sent a letter to the general counsel saying that can't take a position on the removability protections under the act because, you know, President Trump, you know, fired Member Wilcox and explicitly cited, I have the authority to do this, you know, under the Constitution, notwithstanding the act's removal prohibition. So that's the position, you know, of the administration. And the NLRB sent a letter to the court saying, we could talk about other things like subject matter jurisdiction, Norris LaGuardia, et cetera, but, you know, the board won't address the removability issue because the president has taken, you know, a certain position on the matter. Exactly how that all plays out, I'm not sure yet, but what position the NLRB takes on removability, you know, is going to be interesting to see.
Yes, absolutely. I think, Bill, this covers what we had on our planned agenda. Did I miss anything? Anything else that you have on your agenda?
No, that covers it. One little tidbit, though, that I found in rereading the opinion, getting ready for our discussion today, that I found interesting was the board majority's argument under 8C, which really struck me. So the board majority said, among other things, how they could get away with banning mandatory meetings under 8C. They said 8C only applies to unfair labor practice charges where employer motive is an element, but it doesn't apply if employer motive is irrelevant. And that includes under anything alleging that an employer statement is illegal under 8A1. So basically, they're saying that 8C doesn't have any application to the board's suppression of employer speech, that 8C would only apply if motive was an element. So, for example, with a discharge, you know, right line, that kind of thing.
Right.
And that's I've never seen anything like that. That is an incredibly, I mean, if that were true, 8C would be gutted. It would mean that at least under the act, you know, the board would have plenary authority to censor any employer speech or union speech, you know, that it wanted, just as a purely 8A1, 8B1A matter. So anyways, that's sort of something that sort of struck me in the opinion. And I've never seen, you know, the agency take that kind of extreme position before. So hopefully it doesn't survive the light of day, but that struck me.
No, I certainly think that's a valid point. And it just seems to me the broader point here, when we talk about presidents' ability, the chief executive authority, unitary executive authority to remove individuals from executive agencies like the board. And of course, there is a statute that talks about protection for board members. But does the Amazon decision really support the removal of any board member on the theory that Amazon-like decisions have taken on major labor law policy implications, and that this past Biden board had become really a labor policy agency, if you will, not a neutral adjudication agency, and therefore the chief executive should have removal authority. It seems to me Amazon case decision would support overturning Humphrey's executor on that type of theory. And the Cemex case that many on this call are familiar with also took on very major long-range implications of labor policy in this country. So, Bill, any reaction to that as we close out?
No, I think that, you know, it's right. It just shows why, you know, executive officials have to serve, you know, at the pleasure of the president. You know, you have these major radical policy changes, you know, that happened under the Biden board. You know, with respect to this, Cemex, there's a laundry list, you know, of things this board did. And the notion that the president, you know, upon taking, you know, office has no power whatsoever to remove someone who's, you know, engaging in an agenda, which, you know, he apparently disagrees with, you know, sort of really gets to the idea of impeding on executive authority. And, you know, this is one of the decisions, you know, cited by President Trump in his letter. You know, it was joint employer and NLRB censorship of speech, with this being one of the examples. And so, you know, this shows that why President Trump didn't want Member Wilcox to remain on the board. And I think that's a valid reason, you know, as the chief executive who has sole executive authority, you know, should have a constitutional right, that prerogative, you know, to make that decision, of who's serving that kind of, you know, policy and board member role.
Well, as one of our attendees, Jim Young, and hello, Jim, thanks for joining us today, states might the legal challenge by member Wilcox be one of, quote, be careful what you wish for, close quote, category. I think perhaps so. The courts, I think, increasingly are going to be looking at potential reversal of Humphrey's executor, and this case may be the lead case on that issue. But that's another webinar for another day, and I know the Federalist Society will be tracking the whole discussion about the unitary executive theory and Humphrey's executor, so stay tuned for that. Do we have any further questions before we close out? Marco, I don't see any on my screen. Do you, Bill? Did we miss any? I don't believe so. I think we've answered all of our questions or comments. And Bill, thank you very much. Wait, we just had a few. One come up. Let me just check this. Yes, Humphrey's executor, as one attendee says, the Wilcox case is the roadmap for goodbye Humphrey executor. That may very well be true. That would certainly be my prediction. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Bill, excellent comments. Your jurisprudence in this area is well established, and we'll see if the Honey Fund case prediction that you made is a correct one. Marco, we're going to turn it back to you. Thank you to the Federalist Society for having Bill and I this morning or this afternoon.
Well, and thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.